back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, three of them. I use the very large ones that come out of a SCSI drive. They're inches across, half an inch thick. If you stick them to something or stick them together, you take you all night to rip them apart, and you got to be careful you don't hurt yourself pulling them. They bite those magnets between your fingers. And yeah, two to three of them are long, a plexiglass bar with a plexi handle is all it takes. And you pick up just about all sorts of trash in the sand.
How big and how small are some of the things you found with that magnetic device, Charlie?
Well, I've only been trying it since last summer, and I have only found little pieces of strange material that sticks to it. Most of it I've thrown away because it could be just fragments of rusted metal. You just don't know. I haven't found anything that I was excited about yet, at least not on Jones Beach so far. But I've talked to other people who walk around with the metal detectors, and they've found magnetic pieces of material, or metal pieces. And one woman I spoke to actually collected them all, and I told her, you better take those downtown to the Museum of Natural History and see how many of them are actually meteorites that you don't know.
Interesting. You're telling me there's enough impurities in tinfoil that when you put a super strong magnet against tinfoil, you can sense some attraction, particularly if it's hanging from the string. Is that what you're saying? Also, when it's hanging from the string, if I wave the magnet back and forth, I'm creating eddy currents. I'll bet you can set the piece of tinfoil on a string in a swinging motion without even touching it. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, I don't use tinfoil. I use just a small piece of aluminum. Yeah, if you move it, forget it. You could get the whole thing spinning because of the eddy currents. I mean, you just make a magnet, a motor out of it. But if you just go close to it, you'll see it statically pull. Those are from what we believe to be the impurities in the aluminum. At least that's what I'm blaming on. If you move it, then all bets are off. Then it spins like a motor or a watt meter that uses an aluminum disc. But no, I'm talking about watching it as you move the magnet very close, and you'll see it pull off center. You'll actually see an attraction, a static attraction, as opposed to the eddy current effect. And yeah, they're neodymium iron boron. That's what they are.
Very nice. And turns out very few sheets of aluminum we use are pure aluminum. They are all an alloy of quite a few other components. And some of those components are apparently partially magnetic. So you call it impurities. Let's call it other components of the aluminum alloy. 61T6 aluminum alloy, for instance, contains a lot more than just aluminum. Maybe it's only small percentages, but never thought about that. Just look what we could be doing with these super strong magnets, Mel. K2KEY, K2IW.
You know, I got something very unusual. Now, you just reminded me this is K2KEY. I took a motor out of a commercial recorder that they was being chunked, one of the old Sony pneumatic systems. And the motor inside there had, very unusual, I swear, it was a motor that was like a pancake motor, about 4 inches in diameter, and you could see a lot of fields around, and I'm saying this disc on the bottom, this, you know, that fits into, with the shaft goes up the center, what the heck holds the shaft in, because I don't see any kind of, you know, counterpoint or anything. It's held in by some kind of a, I was looking, you know, into the bearing, I see it's held in there by some kind of a pressure or something, because if I pushed on it, I could see a little movement on it. And finally, under putting a lot of strain against the shaft and all, I pushed it, pulled it apart. And that's basically what it is. It's a magnet. It's a pancake motor that uses a big, round, magnetic piece of material pressed into this aluminum casing. And it mates up with this motor that has a lot of poles. It's used as a capstan drive in one of the old commercial recorded, and it's a large, I could say, this magnet is about at least 4 inches or more in diameter, maybe 6 inches in diameter. I have the motor around someplace. I just couldn't bring myself to throw it away. It was so pretty. It's well made and all, because it's nice to play with. You know, if you hold the motor in your hand, it's so well balanced, the bearing and the magnet assembly in there. As you spin it, it just keeps spinning, Dick, almost like a gyroscope over.
So if I understand you correctly, this motor is literally using a magnetic bearing where there is no contact, no grease, no ball bearings. The magnetic field is suspending the shaft in the right position and letting it turn. Is that true?
Exactly. Exactly. This is what's happening. There is a bearing in there, ball bearing, a mini ball bearing drive that the shaft is riding in. And the magnetic field is just riding on this magnetic, in other words, it's just a spacer on the shaft to keep the two magnets apart inside this thing. And so it's pulled in, and in between the spacer is this printed board with a bunch of printed circuit motor. That's the way I only can describe it. It's just printed windings, over.
Okay, I've seen printed circuit motors. But on the shaft of each one of those, I've seen conventional axial ball bearing assemblies. I'm not quite sure whether or not you're telling me now that some portion of this thing doesn't have a physical set of ball bearings for a shaft, but it's got a magnetic suspension system for the shaft. Go by that one again.
Pressed on the center of the shaft, yes, it's a miniature version of your roller bearings, you know, that you use, like, would be in the front end of a car, you know, that Timken-type sealed bearing. You know what I'm talking about, one of those little assemblies. That's pressed onto the center of the shaft, which goes into this housing. But the thing is held together. There's no clip or anything that's holding this thing into its, you know, into its housing. It's the magnet that's holding it in. So it spins extremely free because it's got very little friction, you know, being suspended just on the shaft, on that bearing. But nothing else. In other words, nothing in the back. You would picture a motor, you know, being held in the frame on both ends, a front bearing and a rear bearing, or a rear bushing in front, you know, front and rear bushing. This doesn't have anything like that. It just has the bearing, that one bearing on the shaft that it's held into its system by magnets, over.
Okay, the main bearing that's there, is it intend to center the shaft or just not allow the shaft to move along its length? And the other end of the motor, the shaft is suspended by a magnetic field. I know there's some strong magnets on the printed circuit motor. That's the power portion. But is there only one bearing where you expect two bearings on the shaft and one of them is magnetic? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's just one bearing. Just one bearing pressed onto the center shaft. And then when it goes in the housing, goes into the housing, it's pulled right up by the magnetic force. So that the bearing is just a guide. That's the center capstan that comes up where the you know, the tape is, it goes between the pinch roller and the shaft that comes up. But there's nothing, in other words, it's vertical in the machine. There's nothing to keep this thing from falling out except the magnets, Dick, over.
Interesting. So that's a capstan motor for a very fancy tape recorder, if I understand you. Got to keep an eye out for those kind of things. Whenever I take apart hard drives, I see some very fancy bearings and magnets and Dawson valve movements and all kinds of things. Very high tech. Okay, I'm a little tired from what I've been through this week. I've been in a hot spot, Florida in the summertime. I've never done that for a whole lot of years. So I'm going to start closing down. I'm going to send it back. Oh, let's make sure that Rich hasn't come back. N2EO, are you there? I think he's not. So let us send it back to you to tie some ribbons on it. Go ahead and continue if you want to, but I'm having a little trouble staying awake tonight. Back to you, Mel.
Thanks. Maybe we'll leave for next week. then I had, I could say, a number of inquiries. What the heck is all this stuff about wave angles and all this, you know, jazz, as you would say, about, you know, things that they hear is a takeoff angle. What is a wave angle? What's a takeoff angle? And things like that. So that's just various names, you know, vertical angle of radiation. And what is the association and what does it all mean? So, and how do you, you know, equate it? You know, how is it figured out? How was it determined mathematically and all that goodie? So, all right, I'll tell you what. We'll leave it for next week. I'm sure it's not our share of England. This way we can have a better discussion, I can imagine, you know, and what the weather conditions and all. I know we did a little trip one time about a year or so ago to Arizona for my daughter lived out there, and the difference from going from here into that kind of temperature type of country out there in Arizona. I've been there a number of times. I know what you're talking about. I just particularly not for me, you know, drastic changes of weather. All right, for that, we'll say goodnight to you, Dick. Take care. Have a nice week. And everybody else that joined us, thank you for the emails. They're very, very encouraging, and we'll try to continue doing some interesting discussions and experiments. Always a pleasure. This is behalf of K2RIW, myself, K2KEY, 73s, and unless somebody wants to ask me something, Dick, good night, take care, and have a good night, please.
Okay, I'll put in a couple of sentences on wave angle. At first I thought by wave angle you meant phase shift between two signals. Every antenna's got an antenna pattern to it. So if I take a horizontally polarized Yagi, mount it on a vertical mast, put an antenna rotator below it, rotate it, take the signal coming up and coming out of the antenna, put it to a strip chart recorder, and allow the strip chart recorder to run while the antenna is rotated, you're going to get an antenna pattern. Since you're rotating the antenna in azimuth, you're going to get an azimuthal antenna pattern. Most people understand that. By the same token, if you had another kind of a bearing system, a gimbal system, so that you could move the antenna in elevation, and you ran the strip chart recorder, whether there's a signal strength downrange supplying the signal on this antenna range, and you have the antenna at the point of measurement, and now you swing the antenna in elevation, you're going to get an elevation antenna pattern. In general, the elevation antenna pattern will look different than the horizontal antenna pattern. That's just the nature of antennas. Very few antennas. Only a cavity-backed spiral antenna is the only one I know where it comes very close to the identical pattern. But these patterns, where you sweep the antenna in azimuth or sweep the antenna in elevation, in the antenna vocabulary are called cardinal plane cuts. Cardinal plane, the word cardinal means main, and cut really means if you took a sphere, if you took your globe off of the table, so to speak, where you've got your globe of the Earth, and if you did a slice right through the equator, that would be the azimuthal cut, cardinal plane cut. If you did a cut through the globe where you went from North Pole to South Pole, and you did it right through the prime meridian at Greenwich, England, that would be a vertical plane cardinal cut. So those two antenna patterns are a way of swinging the antenna to literally plot the pattern of that cut on a globe, so to speak. Well, that's not the only cardinal plane cuts. You can also have what are called conic cuts. If I did a slice through the globe at 40 degrees latitude, in other words, I adjust my knife so it's parallel to the equator, but I move it further north before I do the cut. And those places where the knife cut through the globe right at the 40 degree north latitude, if I connected every one of those points to the absolute center of the sphere, I would be tracing out a cone. I'd be tracing out a circular symmetric cone. why that kind of an antenna pattern, when you use the right kind of a gimbal structure on the antenna during the measurement, you can sort of see why it's called a conic cut, a non-cardinal plane cut. So there's a zillion ways you can swing the antenna when you try to measure its antenna pattern. And if you do enough of those swings, record enough data, and put it all into the right kind of a three-dimensional spherical antenna pattern plot thing, you would really know in all of space what the antenna pattern is like. When you look at the right textbook and you look at the pattern, the three-dimensional pattern of a dipole, it does look like a fat donut. It's called the torus antenna pattern. In reality, if you wanted to really measure that, because you know ahead of time what it's going to look like, you don't have to measure that. But to really measure all that, there's a lot of data in that spherical antenna pattern, the three-dimensional pattern of that torus. So more complicated antennas, you really do have to measure all that data. If you divided your globe into 1 degree horizontal, 1 degree latitude, and 1 degree longitude squares, and you add them all up, there's 41,253 square degrees on the surface of a sphere. So in theory, if you want 1 degree resolution of the antenna pattern of your antenna in three-dimensional space, you're taking 41,253 measurements as a minimum. You rapidly see that to truly document an antenna is a heroic effort. Now, when it comes to the antennas that we amateurs typically build for HF service, you think you're installing one antenna, as I mentioned earlier. In reality, you're installing at least two antennas, one above the ground, and for free of charge, you've got the mirror image of an antenna below the ground. And for a horizontally polarized wave that strikes the earth, you get a beautiful reflection that follows the law, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. That part we understand. The part that's not always made clear is that that signal that's horizontally polarized, that strikes the ground at a grazing angle, it reflects off the ground, you know what angle it's going to reflect, but the ground creates a phase shift of 180 degrees. That's just the magic of a E-field that's parallel to a conducting surface. The echo signal is 180 degrees out of phase. And so your antenna above the ground and the mirror image of the antenna below the ground is really a two-element phased array where the two elements are fed out of phase with each other. So therefore, on the horizon, there is a null, because on the horizon you've got an equal signal from above the ground, equal signal from below the ground, but 180 degrees out of phase, and it gives you a cancellation on the horizon. You don't get a complete cancellation on the ground, on the horizon, because the signal reflected off the ground does suffer a little bit of insertion loss. Therefore, the two signals are not equal, and you don't get perfect cancellation. But you do get a kind of a null. Now, depending on what elevation you set your antenna at, whether it's 20 feet off the ground or 40 feet off the ground, and in those two cases, the separation between the real and the image antenna would be 40 and 80 feet apart. Because of that angle, because of that separation, when you plot it in wavelengths, you'll soon discover there are certain elevation angles where the two signals that started out of phase come back in phase. If I'm up at roughly a 45 degree elevation angle and I look down at your antenna, the mirror image antenna has a longer path for the signal to flow rather than the direct signal path from the real antenna. And if that extra signal path length happens to be a half wavelength longer, then what started out of phase turns out to be in phase. So you could have a vertical pattern, in elevation, you're plotting the pattern, and there could be a peak of beam in that direction, in that elevation direction, and that azimuth direction. So therefore, every antenna in HF service, at some number of feet above ground, at some particular band, like 80 meter, 40 meter, 20 meter band, has a peak of beam in elevation. Therefore, people talk about the elevation angle, the angle in elevation where the signal is strongest. It doesn't mean there isn't signal at other elevation angles and other azimuth angles, but there is a peak of beam in that area. And so there's a formula you can go to in the antenna handbook, ARRL antenna handbook, as well as many other books. Once you know the frequency you're at, which really is wavelength, once you know the number of feet above the ground and something about the nature of the conductivity of the ground, you can then do a pretty easy prediction of what elevation angle will be the peak of beam. So that's the beginning of the discussion. Mel and I will go a little bit deeper into it next week. So, I'm going to say 73, you all. I'm going to modulate the feathers. Bye-bye. This was TechNet number 1122 of the series that began way back in the dark ages of 1982. I think Mel and I will be back next week, as long as we're in good health, and we'll discuss more of this jazz, as they say. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW TechNet Limark, and with K2KUY, we're clear.
Hey, thank you, Dick. 73 to you. Yes, next week we'll go into a little further in depth. We'll explain to you about the difference of low angle and high angle, and also I'll give the formula to determine for that frequency you're operating on, what the approximate angle that antenna is producing for that your particular location. I also give angles for the optimum wave angles for the lowest and also the optimum wave angles for the highest on the different HF bands. And again, like I say, how to compute your particular situation. Again, I'll just make one quick disclaimer then. Because your antenna may not fall in the category that after you do the computation, that if you find that your, gee, my antenna is too low, that, oh boy, I don't think it's going to work. It's just, this is actually theoretically what would be if you could do the best of all worlds. Doesn't mean that the antenna is still not going to work out fairly well. So we'll go into that, like I say, that a little bit more in depth next week. I know basically that's what the questions were. What does it, mean to me, all this, and how does it apply to my particular situation individually? And so that's what I mean, that we'll get into that discussion. So 73s all, have a good week. Take care. And thank you for joining us. This is K2KY and K2RIW, both saying 73s. And I'll go QRT too, unless somebody wants to.